From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Cheryl Smith's son has autism. In an essay she wrote, she says she wishes she could go inside Carson's head, even for just a bit, to see what was going on in there. But then she says she realized she would still be an outsider. Carson gets it, she writes. I don't. So I continue to try and pull him into my world. Today in the program, we're talking about this experience of autism and how that experience is unique or different here in Utah. The state has one of the highest rates of autism in the country. So we're talking about why today, which raises the questions of cause, of course, but that always leads to the question of what you do about autism as a reality in your life. We invite you to join us today after this news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West of Doug Fabrizio. 1 in 54 Utah children have autism spectrum disorder, which is a number that's higher than almost every other state. In fact, New Jersey is the only other state with a higher rate. And people, of course, have been puzzling over that for years now. This is very difficult because researchers haven't really identified a definitive cause. And so parents and others are left to wonder if this is a genetic thing or if this is an environment thing. Of course, if you're in Utah, the question always comes up, does Utah's bad air quality play a role in all of this? Well, today in the program, we're talking about the experience of autism in Utah, and not just the factors that may be causing it, but how the state has developed a kind of vibrant community of activists and an infrastructure. We invite you to join us today if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Dr. Sam Goldstein is with us. He's a neuropsychologist here at the University of Utah. He developed the autism spectrum rating scales, which is used around the world to identify and treat children. Among his 44 books on autism are Raising Resilient Children with Autism Spectrum Disorder and a children's book, which we'll talk about on the program, called Billy and the Rockhounds, illustrated by a teen with ASD, Julia Adams. Dr. Goldstein, welcome back. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Doug.
We also have with us Dr. Jamie Christensen, a director of schools for Spectrum Academy. It's a charter school for children with autism spectrum disorder. They have an elementary school and a secondary school in North Salt Lake. They're going to be opening a school for kindergarten through eighth grade in Pleasant Grove this fall. And we'll talk about those schools a little bit, too, as we go along. But Dr. Christensen, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We also have Cheryl Smith with us, president of the Autism Council of Utah. It's an independent umbrella group focused on coordinating the efforts of families, agencies, and advocacy organizations. She also serves on the board of the Pingree Center for Children with Autism and several other organizations. And her 16-year-old son, Carson, has autism. And Cheryl Smith, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Okay, Cheryl, I want to start with you. When Carson was diagnosed, when you got a definitive diagnosis, what was your reaction, like your first reaction?
Grief is the first reaction. He's not the kid you thought he was going to be. Yeah. All of your dreams change. And then it's pretty dark and devastating because you're not sure where to go from there as a parent.
You know, it's interesting you've talked about how you wrote this essay that I read about the experience with Carson. One of the things you write about is that you really wonder what your life is going to be like. So once it settles in, now you figure what's this going to be like for not just me, for him and for us, the family, right?
Right. The whole rest of the family. It's really, it hits you in every area of your life, emotionally, spiritually, financially, physically even. Yeah. It really hits you everywhere. But once you get a path and you start going down that path, and you start seeing some changes for the better and whatnot, your dreams change. They turn into other things. Mm. And you see that even though there is a lot of stress and challenges, there's also a lot of goodness and sweetness that comes from that.
Yeah. It is interesting you say once you get a diagnosis, there's that grief, but then there's also that sense of relief because now at least you've figured it out. Right?
Yeah. Why is the kid tantruming? Why is he doing that? At least you have an answer then and you can research what's out there and go forward.
Dr. Goldstein, that idea of grief, is that a natural kind of reaction?
Well, I think all parents have these planning stages, BC, before children, and you anticipate the kind of child you will have and the kind of parent you will be. And for some parents, that becomes a reality. But for many of us, there's a period of time when you begin to fit who you are as an adult and as a parent and your personality and your child's personality and temperament. And whether we're talking about a developmental problem such as autism or a physical problem, children with cancer or other challenging disabilities, there is that challenge for parents when the child and their plans aren't progressing the way they would like them to be. It's a very difficult thing. And I think anger comes even before grief.
Hmm.
And then there's a sense of resolve.
Anger about what? Just
anger that
this is happening to me? Or
correct.
Yeah.
That this is happening to me and why my child? And then there's the grief that Cheryl describes. And then if there are resources and support, then there's the realization that all is not as dark and as bad as it appears to be. And then the best part of it at the end is the journey you're on with the child and when you realize the strengths and assets and the uniqueness that different children bring to the world.
Is that an important part of all of this, this idea of recognizing, okay, so my child has autism spectrum disorder, but that doesn't mean they fit in this group, that they're still unique people. Is that an important part of understanding that? Doctor, I want to hear from you on that as well.
Yes, it definitely is a huge part in that because our kids that have an autism spectrum disorder, most of them have so many different unique talents and gifts. And instead of focusing on the things that they lack and trying to bring those up to what a typical standard would be, when we take the approach of focusing on their strengths, then we're really giving them some tools for the future and showing them what's possible for them.
Cheryl Smith, you're really nodding there.
Well, they often say if you've met a kid with autism, you've met one kid with autism.
Right.
Because the spectrum is huge, they can be brilliant in some things and have deficits in others, but they're all totally different, just like our typical kids.
Yeah. Is that an important thing to understand, is that how the spectrum ranges and that you don't just define them by this one thing?
I think it's very important. And we should understand that all children share qualities with all children and then qualities that are unique to a subgroup, whatever that is, an asset or a liability, and then qualities that are unique to them. And we have a tendency to focus on that middle group, okay, you have autism, and fail to appreciate that there's probably more benefit to be derived in helping the child and family by appreciating how they are similar to all children and how they are unique each and of themselves, regardless, as Cheryl points out, of whether or not they have a disability or a challenge or any kind of functional limitation.
Are we better at this now? Are we I had a sense of – I wondered what it was, say, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. What was our sort of the conventional understanding of autism if we even had one?
Well, if we go back a little further, there was the predominant psychoanalytic view in the 50s and early 60s that this was caused by refrigerator mothers.
Yeah, yeah.
Cold,
we blamed moms, didn't we? Yeah.
Blame moms and they take the blame like Joan of Arc and move on. But I think we've increasingly recognized that it does have a genetic basis, but that biology is not destiny. It affects probability. And that experience over time is as powerful, if not more powerful, in shaping one's life than in this case, the genes that comprise autism. The big change has been our focus on that the condition really is a social learning problem and that the odd behaviors or the atypical interests that so distract us when children are younger, most of them are outgrown. And as adults, their challenge, the reason that one out of three still doesn't work and one out of two still lives at home, has to do with socialization. More so than others.
And the sense that we're failing at that? We haven't figured that out?
Well, we figured it out, But it takes time. This is a 20-year project for children born today. We figured it out. But despite all of the programs we have for children now and the interest and the knowledge, and in this state, I think, a wonderful network of professionals and parents and a legislature that will fund money for services for children in schools that will provide service, it'll take a while before we know the effect, because children with autism transitioning to adulthood today are not faring much better than children 15 or 20 years ago.
So I wonder about – I want to get to this question of cause a little bit more, because I want to work through some of these things, because the question comes up about why Utah somehow is distinct or may be distinct. One of the things, Cheryl Smith, that you write about, you say this, you say in your essay that you wish you could get inside Carson's head, even for a bit, to see what's going on in there, which I get. I understand that. But then then you write this. You say, but you realize you would still be an outsider.
Yeah, because I think he gets it, and he gets where he's at in his world and what he enjoys and what he doesn't and what bugs him. And because he's virtually nonverbal, but I wonder why does he probably wonders, why do I have to go be like them? Why do I have to come out of what I'm in? Because I'm good.
Yeah. You know, I get it. This is my place.
Yeah,
I'm here.
I'm good. Why do I have to go conform to what they want me to do? Why do I have to sit in this chair and do this project when I want to be over here doing this thing? And he can go from 0 to 90. So he can be fine doing something, and then all of a sudden he has really serious self-injurious behavior. And I don't know what even sets him off. It would be nice to know what's going on in there, but I still don't know if I'd get it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so I wanted to ask you this, Dr. Christensen, because Cheryl writes, she says, so I continue to try and pull him into my world while I wonder – well, I'm sure he wonders what's wrong with his, like you just said. Like, he gets it. He's comfortable in there. But she talks about how she's trying to pull him into her world. Is that sort of the tension going on there, the idea of letting them live in the world that they're comfortable with, but also getting them to adapt into this world?
It is, and it's really finding the appropriate balance for, you know, the whole goal is to help our kids become successful in whatever way that is, once they, you know, graduate from high school, once they are involved in their community, and how to do that in a way that allows them to hold a job if they can, to have friends, to live in and amongst other people in a community. And so that's where we try to find a balance. We don't want to take who they are away, but we want to provide them with a mechanism to be able to participate in things when they want to.
Mm. You said, Dr. Goldstein, you talked about it being a developmental issue, right?
Correct.
So let's talk a little bit about that. The idea is – I guess the question is, if it's a developmental issue, how much of this is – how much of that is genetic versus how much of that is the way we interact with them in these early days? Because you write about these kind of social impairments. They have a hard time developing appropriate social connections. They don't know how to respond to social cues. They're not entirely sure how to initiate interactions. But they can develop those things?
They can develop those things. And as a corollary, I'll give you an example. A child might have all of the genetics to develop normal language. And we know that if no one speaks to that child,
they won't.
They never speak, whereas that child never has to see anyone walk in order to get up and walk. So things we've been doing as a species for a very long time, we do instinctually. Later emerging abilities like language that are polygenetic, like socialization, that are multiple genes playing that role, you have to have a push from the environment. And the emerging research is very powerful. You find children with social learning problems like this at an early age, and you immerse them, as it were, in an environment designed to give them many more opportunities in a guided way to learn how to socialize, to take perspective, to have conversation, to play appropriately. And we find in peer-reviewed scientific research very positive changes. Those children still have autism, I still have poor vision, but when I put my glasses on, when we give them opportunities to acquire social knowledge, socialization is knowledge. You're not born knowing how to socialize. Right. You're born wanting to socialize, but not knowing how.
But it's not necessarily, I don't think, a lack, because they don't have social skills means they were never taught or modeled those social skills. You know, kids with autism have a deficit in that area, and the difference then becomes how the types of interventions that they have and the exposure that they have to social situations as being the difference in their abilities.
So if a child who does not have is not on the autism spectrum disorder, they're better at adapting to these social cues. They somehow through osmosis or whatever, they get it. They're able to adapt to them. They take these cues that most of us would. But kids who have autism spectrum disorder, they're not getting that connection. They have to be drawn to that. It has to be pointed out to them. It has to be more apparent than something that's more unconscious for other people. Is that putting it right?
So two responses to that. First, newborn babies have an affinity to be connected because someone has to take care of them. Right. They make eye contact. They have a social smile. Their ears rest within the range of women's voices, believe it or not. They would prefer looking at women's faces over men. I prefer women over men. But so they're kind of programmed to attach to us, and we love babies. Even men raise their voices to sound like women when they speak to them. So this challenge, this developmental, and I use the term to mean an emerging biological difference, affects them at a very early age. The way I explain it to parents is the equivalent of teaching a poorly coordinated child to ride a bicycle. They know how to do it, but they need many more opportunities in smaller increments over a longer period of time in a nurturing environment so that they don't become alienated and frustrated. Mm. So I don't know that it's so much drawing them to it as much as seeing what they enjoy doing and finding a way to take that activity and make it social. One of the boys I've seen in the past who loved to draw also but was only a fifth grader and would do that all of the time by himself, and he had a diagnosed autism. But he had language, so you could understand him. Language is the window into the mind. The teacher made a cartooning club and made him the president. And there were a number of other kids who enjoyed drawing, and they would sit together and draw. And at least there was some opportunity for him to talk and socialize.
So, Cheryl, knowing this, what we've been talking about, how has that translated into the way you deal with Carson? How you parent?
Oh, boy. That's a hard question. I try to create a lot of opportunities for him. And now that he's 16, even though cognitively he's probably 4, he likes to be with big kids. He likes to do age-appropriate activities. We've just started at the Pingree Center a new program for the adolescents where they can go into the school district and garden with the kids at City Academy. And then the kids can come over to the Pingree Center and help our kids do a garden. So creating opportunities for him to have with other older kids in a social environment. He's learning to say hi, and he gets right in your face. He has no personal boundaries, right? Yeah. But he's practicing, and he'll look at your badge and say your name. And it's fun to watch, and it's fun to see him enjoy himself.
Cheryl Smith is with us. She is president of the Autism Council of Utah. Joining us here, we have Dr. Jamie Christensen, Director of Schools for Spectrum Academy, and Dr. Sam Goldstein, a neuropsychologist at the University of Utah. He has a number of books. Among them is a children's book called Billy and the Rock Hounds, which was illustrated by a teen with ASD, Julia Adams. There is a short documentary, in fact, about Julia and about Dr. Goldstein's relationship, talking about this on videowest.kuer.org. We're also, we should say, highlighting a piece called Sensory Overload, which explores the intensity in the way an autistic child encounters the world of sound. Again, all of that on our Video West page. We'll tell you a little bit more about that as you go along. We invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we are talking about autism. One of the questions we're talking about is why Utah has some of the highest rates of autism spectrum disorder in the United States, which is difficult because science hasn't exactly identified a definitive cause. So we're talking about that mix of factors. And of course, what do you do about all of that? 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We have Dr. Sam Goldstein with us, a neuropsychologist here at the University of Utah, one of the leading experts about these questions, really in the country and the world in many ways. He developed the autism spectrum rating scales, which is used around the world to identify and treat children. We also have Cheryl Smith with us, president of the Autism Council of Utah. Her 16-year-old son, Carson, has autism. And Dr. Jamie Christensen is with us, director of Schools for Spectrum Academy. And again, you can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Dr. Goldstein, you've talked about how each person's journey with autism spectrum disorder is shaped by this variety of factors. We've been talking about this. So we talked a little bit about genetics, what we know about that. I wanted to talk about some of these other things because I think they're interesting. What is inborn temperament?
Inborn temperament are those qualities that children bring to the world before we as their caregivers have a chance to, and I sometimes say tongue-in-cheek, screw them up or influence them. I mean, every child has
who they are.
Who they are. They have a certain temperament. Some children have easy temperament. If you look at the research, this goes back a long way, and it at one time was very popular in the Dr. Spock era. And now temperament isn't talked about as much. We've given clinical labels to temperamental qualities. The slow to warm up child is now the shy, socially anxious child. The very active child is now the child with ADHD. So maybe we've substituted one label for another, but these are temperamental qualities. Some children wake up in the morning with a smile on their face and they're very easy and they fit routines well and they manage emotions well, and other children struggle to learn how to do that. And sometimes it's lack of opportunity for appropriate care, but more often than not, it's simply a lack of fit between the environment and what the child needs given their temperament.
You also say that the broader society or culture is one of those factors. In what way?
Well, the broader society or culture is one of the three areas in which we think risk and protection operates. So when we talk about resilience, the ability to function well in the face of adversity and then overcome that over time, so it's not recovery, we talk about factors within the person, as in temperament, factors within the immediate family, because research on autism finds that environmental factors are equally powerful in predicting whether you'll receive a diagnosis of autism, and then factors within the extended community. And for some children, the family is much more powerful than the community or school, and for others, the family isn't as available or supportive, but the school plays an important role. We each have a different journey in terms of how inborn or innate qualities, immediate family qualities, extended environment qualities shape and influence all of our lives.
Mm. Values is one.
Well, again, I think you're referring to some of our guideposts for
parents. Well, I want to get to the guideposts, but this is you just list these things that are sort of how we're shaped by these factors. And I found it interesting that values is in there, that society and culture is in there. You know, that it's not just it's just how diverse all of these things that are coming together are that have this powerful influence on something like this.
Well, and I think your observation speaks to why we can't ever predict how anyone's going to turn out. I tell parents, if we want to know how your 5-year-old will be functioning as a 16-year-old, we'll wait till he's 15 years, 3/4, and then I will tell you. It's a very complex equation trying to factor all of these things into play. And for autism spectrum in particular, and the term spectrum is an interesting one, again, the diversity of presentation and the impact of other variables. For autism, when I evaluate children and we talk about their achievement or their intellect, I tell parents that until they're at least 12 or older, we're going to make no estimates about what their potential is, because children with autism tend to not have that social contract. They're not as concerned about showing us what they know. And when we evaluate them, You can get them to work for you, even kids that are verbal, but they never really put themselves out there to show you, see what I know, because they're much more interested in telling you about their particular interests, Pokemon or baseball or whatever, and these other things you want them to do are just a minor inconvenience they have to endure to get to where they can talk to you about what they're interested in.
Well, let's get to the one of the big questions anyway here, and that is Utah. It's such a basic question. Why does Utah have some of the highest rates in the country? Why?
I'm happy to continue.
Dr. Jamie Christians, let me ask you. I'm sure you both have a hunch or a sense of it anyway. And maybe the answer is who knows. Is that the answer?
No, that's not the answer.
Well, it is a difficult thing, and I know Dr. Goldstein has definite opinions on it. I'll tell you what kind of the sense of the community is regarding that, and those kind of things are still being researched right now. But
debated,
yeah. Certainly. There's plenty of, as you alluded to earlier, research on inversions and whether that increases. There is speculation as to, well, it's genetic and we have more children in Utah, so naturally you're going to see a higher incidence of autism, and that we are better at diagnosing now, and that children are having a more of an opportunity to be diagnosed in a school setting as well, because we're getting better at it and we're following response to intervention protocols and things that would enable us to spot those things and really then move toward evaluation.
So a couple of things. First, keep in mind these studies. The CDC study was a telephone survey. No one checked to make sure.
We're not entirely sure.
But we know that they did the same phone survey everywhere.
Yeah.
And the chart review that the incidence is pointed out of Utah being higher or New Jersey now being the highest is very selective. It's 14 states. It's not in every state. It's in certain counties, not in every county. Doesn't match the U.S. Census. I think it's clear that, as Jamie points out, this has been a research center for autism for a very long time. This is a family-oriented community, so we're concerned about helping children who have differences. The prevalence and incidence issue, I think if you have more children, you'll have a higher potential incidence, but not a higher prevalence per number of children in the community. It shouldn't be any higher. We have a legislature that has been very responsive, one of the few that have apportioned money in an experimental way to see if it makes a difference. I think there are a lot of reasons why. We've had a very generous benefactor who donated money to start the Pingree School. We have a charter school that this fall will be serving nearly 900 children. And again, not all of them have autism spectrum because charters can't select. They have to take who comes through the lottery.
Right.
We have a school system that is very responsive to the behavioral kinds of interventions that are good for children with autism to which they respond. I think there are a lot of reasons why. And I think that we're a very good model we're a very good model for how parents and professionals and schools and the community at large and even healthcare carriers can work together to help children.
And so if I could interject, having lived in New Jersey most recently, I know that they have a lot of services that they have provided for people on the autism spectrum. And so you see a big influx of people moving from all around the country to that area because they have those services. And so that is definitely one factor in the increased numbers.
And so do we.
There
so
as
maybe
well.
That's why,
and
right?
That's right.
Yeah.
If you look at the State Office of Ed information, that trajectory goes just like the Swiss Alps. It doesn't ever plateau off. So the bad news is that there's that many kids everywhere, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Definition is an issue. We have
right.
When I first trained, autism was only provided to children who had serious developmental delays, as well as self-injurious behavior, as well as the social problems. And we've slowly softened the diagnosis and the diagnostic criteria. We've also added a new diagnosis in the past year called social pragmatic communication disorder in an effort to avoid over-diagnosing. All children with autism have social pragmatic language problems, but not all children with social pragmatic language problems
have
autism. And so we're trying to get better at parsing out those children who have functional needs. And again, we serve and treat and educate the functional limitation and impairment. In the end, I'm not as concerned about the diagnosis. For me, the diagnosis is a way of tracking children and maybe mitigating risk over time. I can compare you to a risk group. But sometimes we get too caught up. I just had a parent come in, and a professional told them that their child didn't have autism because he was missing one symptom. And it's preposterous to hear a professional say that, but I can understand why they say it, because they're trained. You don't have the diagnosis.
Yeah. Here's an looks like an email from Sarah, who says she's frustrated with the typical answers about why the rates are so high in Utah. She writes, I heard the CDC's past chief investigator for autism in Utah. She was very clear about why neither of the genetic question or the overdiagnosis question was plausible. She writes this, the main point I want to share is that she made a direct link anyway between the pollution in Utah and autism rates, and that once she did this, she was not allowed to make her findings public because it then became a political and a financial problem. Now, so this some idea that someone's trying to cover up this question about this causal link between pollution and autism. I don't know. Dr. Goldstein, can you say anything about that at all?
Well, as a scientist, if we haven't proven it, and we haven't disproven it, technically, I shouldn't have an opinion. Is it possible? Let's pick an example that I do have an opinion about. The incidence of autism and autistic symptoms and behaviors in young children who suffer periventricular hemorrhage at birth, and between 1 out of 4 to 1 out of 5 children who suffer strokes like that at birth develop autistic symptoms, and some remit over time and some remain autistic. So the question is, can something beyond genetics cause autism? Can brain injury cause autism? Yes. Are there all kinds of teratogens and toxins and things in the environment or physical experiences that could cause a brain injury? Yes. So it's certainly plausible. But are these things the primary cause of autism? Hasn't been proven, even for ADHD, where lead hasn't been implicated yet in autism. It will be eventually. But lead has been known in areas where children are closer to lead in the air before unleaded gasoline. You found a higher incidence of learning disabilities and a higher incidence of ADHD, but not autism. But that was a time when we defined autism differently. Diagnoses change, environments change, and you try and compare data from 30 years ago to today.
Cheryl Smith, how are you thinking about this? Because I know you believe that a toxin, mercury, was related to Carson's diagnosis. Do you not?
Well, his story is at 22 months, he bit a mercury thermometer. The babysitter called. We rushed to the hospital. They showed me the mercury. We went home. Within a week, he did not speak. He did not look at me. He looked up in the ceiling. We thought he was deaf. Whether he would have autism anyway, I don't know. I feel like that was his environmental trigger. I don't know. You know, I know you have to have the genetic makeup, but it's such a mystery right now to parents anyway, because there's no really conclusive cure or cause or, you know, any of that. So I think that there are environmental triggers for sure. I think that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in response to that, we haven't mentioned mercury. Mercury could very well cause something like that to happen to a child whose brain is just forming in the first few years of life. Again, you see single case examples of children who seem normal and asymptomatic who have exposure to certain toxins. Yes, these things happen. Is it the primary cause? Probably not. And are those children vulnerable? Well, I would argue that these children who have brain injuries early on and then develop autism, they probably weren't destined to have autism, or the social learning problems associated with it. And Cheryl's child has not just the social learning, but he has very delayed intellectual development. He has a whole host of other kinds of behavioral problems that are associated with exposure to certain heavy metals.
Wow. So not they weren't. It's possible that some weren't destined for that.
It's likely that some of those children who had brain injury at birth weren't destined, and it's likely that someone like Cheryl's child. I have no way of proving or disproving
sure.
it, but it's certainly likely that might not have happened. I do see children who have unfortunate exposure to heavy metals or have brain injuries and move from appearing to be very normal to very abnormal, even at later ages.
But I think this is why just hearing all of this, a definitive cause is so elusive to us because there are so many different factors and there's so much research going in right now. I know there's research going on as to the level of the frequency of ultrasounds and whether that might be. I mean, there's so many different things that are possibilities that's what makes it so difficult.
Let me just add one thing. In the past, when I did research with ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, the first thing we would do is ask parents, has your child been exposed to an adverse experience, a brain injury, a chemical poisoning, anything that might contribute to those symptoms? And then we throw them out of the study because we're trying to study children who most likely do not have other environmental or related causes, but whose cause is primarily genetic. So we do that with all of these childhood conditions, and therefore, when a child has autism that may be contributed to by mercury, and we say, well, he has autism, you need to know that children we studied to identify the condition of autism excluded children who had exposure to heavy metals.
Let's take a call. 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join the conversation. This is Patrick in Salem, Utah. Patrick, welcome.
Thank you. It's a great honor to be on. Dr. Goldstein, I really owe my success in life to him. I'm learning disabled, and he treated me as a small child. And today I'm a school teacher that works with at-risk kids. And, you know, it's frustrating that I see parents coming in that they have a child that, you know, they love dearly that's a little bit different. And they search for, a diagnosis. And this year there's been two in cases where, you know, I took part as the teacher for doing the spectrum test and whatnot. And they, you know, no, to me, not as a medical professional, but to me, I'm thinking there's no way this child has autism. He's just a different kid. And yet, I talked to the school psychologist, I talked to the district, social workers. They come back and say, no, he doesn't have autism. And then 2 weeks later, in my mailbox, I get a special ed file, and they're diagnosing him. And to me, it's a disservice to children that have this spectrum disorder. But it's also a really big disservice, I believe, to the child who's falsely diagnosed, whether it's by a medical professional or by a school psychologist. Any comments on that?
Patrick, it's good to hear from you. Haven't talked to you in a long time.
I'm coming in to see you this summer.
for a visit.
Great honor.
Good. Well, I do have a comment. I think, I spend my career trying to separate science from nonsense. And just so much wrong information floats around about behavioral or developmental conditions because, as Jamie points out, they're hard to pinpoint. They're hard to identify. And I think it's an equal disservice. Somewhere there's a world in which children are identified by their need and they're eligible for service or assistance by need, not by crossing diagnostic threshold.
Kathy, I want to hear you on that. Kathy, on our Facebook page, writes that they've made it harder to even get diagnosed, so a child who could really use early intervention has to wait until it's painfully obvious that someone's on the spectrum.
I don't know that I necessarily agree with that as much as maybe the willingness of particular school systems or districts to make that diagnosis, because then that means there are a whole lot of services that they have to provide for that child. And sometimes it's a matter of thinking, we need to really see how that child performs over a period of time and how they respond to certain types of interventions to see. You know, unfortunately, the criteria in the school system is that if the disability does not adversely affect their educational performance, then they're not eligible to receive those services. So it's a little bit different diagnostic criteria within a school system than it would be outside in the medical community.
There's a question here that may sort of get to all of this, too. This person who wanted to be anonymous writes, in my experience with the public schools and from what I'm hearing, children with autism and other special needs will be forced out of the public schools in increasing numbers, partly due to a general inability or an unwillingness of the system to deal with these kids, and partly due to a law, the laws like No Child Left Behind and Common Core. Is that part of what you're talking about here? Some concern about that they're being left out? And whether or not you think it's because of Common Core or anything like that, I mean, is there an unwillingness, an increasing unwillingness?
Common Core doesn't have anything. No Child Left Behind certainly was that all children, no matter what, despite disability, would be on grade level by a certain date. And, well, that's for another topic, another day. But I think it more pertains to this movement toward inclusion and the unwillingness to separate that student to give them instruction in a different type of environment. And when they do move toward inclusion, we're just not very good at that. Mm. And so how to do that in an appropriate way that still serves their needs is a difficulty. However, I don't think there's necessarily a move to push them out of being identified as needing special ed services. Schools do have a cap on the number of students with IEPs, and so once they reach that cap, then they're probably more looking for ways to serve them without an IEP.
Mm. We've been advocating for what we call the high risk pool for special ed, because some of the kids with special needs take all the funds. They have dual diagnosis. They have a lot of things going on physically and emotionally, and it doesn't leave a lot of money left for whoever's left in the class. We haven't been successful getting more funding for that, but we keep trying. And I don't think it's the fault of the school district. They do a great job, and there's pockets of excellence everywhere, in my opinion. School and private, I mean public and private, but they have to know everything about everybody, and they have to have the funds to make that work, and they have a lot of restrictions, so it's tough.
It's very tough, and that's true. The key is there is so many things that need to be implemented, and there's only X amount of dollars to do it with, and so really to serve those students appropriately, more money needs to be filtered through.
We've gotten a number of questions related to insurance. Nicole writes, I've noticed that my Utah-based insurance, Select Health, excludes treatments related to autism spectrum disorder, whereas my children's father's insurance, which is based outside of the state, doesn't have that exclusion. Is this a matter of state law? That is, do some states require insurance to cover ASD-related treatment and some states don't?
Yeah,
that's true.
The insurance mandates, we got them passed last year. They don't kick in until 2016, but Utah will have an insurance mandate for autism.
So Nicole just has to wait a couple of years.
Yeah.
Well, then
right.
The question is when they will cover it, what they will fund.
Yeah. True, and how old the kid is and
there are always those kind of limitations, and we know that there are a few limitations on this recent legislation.
801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Patrick, thanks very much. You can join us, email radiowest@kuer.org. We have with us Cheryl Smith, president of the Autism Council of Utah. We have Dr. Jamie Christensen, director of schools for Spectrum Academy. It's a charter school for children with autism spectrum disorder. Although all comers are invited, right? You sort of have to be.
This is right.
Yeah,
we
that's
are
right.
publicly funded.
That's right. Okay. And also Dr. Sam Goldstein, of course, neuropsychologist at the University of Utah. He has written a number of books. Among them is a children's book that he wrote with Julia Adams. She's a teen who has ASD. It's called Billy and the Rock Hounds, and it is the latest Video West video. You'll get to see her there at videowest.kuer.org. We're going to take another quick break and be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about autism spectrum disorder and the particular questions related to Utah. Dr. Sam Goldsmith is with us, a neuropsychologist at the University of Utah. We have Dr. Jamie Christensen, a director of schools for Spectrum Academy. Cheryl Smith, also with us, president of the Autism Council of Utah. Let's go back to the phones. Casey is with us in Logan, Utah. Casey, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering if you could talk a little more about the assessment and treatment options now for children with ASDs, that especially since the passage of State Bill 57, that insurance companies are required to pay for specific assessment and treatment options, and who provides those services and who should provide those services?
Well, the services should be provided by a licensed physician or psychologist, sometimes a social worker, in terms of the diagnostic process. But a diagnosis is only one step in the process of an assessment. An assessment gathers all the data one needs to actually make a difference, to do something. And to do that, you need information from the schools if you're in the community. And if you're in the schools and you really want to make a difference, you need information from families. Although, as Cheryl pointed out, there's a reticence to do that because the identification of autism in the schools is not necessarily the same as a diagnosis of autism in the community. And then the person doing it should have some training. It shouldn't be done by checklist. I had an insurance screener on the phone last year tell me that the diagnosis of autism was fairly straightforward. There was only about 15 questions you need to ask. And if you get yes to the first group for two and yes to the next group, and you have autism. And I tried to explain that if we do that, we're going to diagnose one out of five children with autism. It's a good place to start, but not a good place to finish. So I think you need someone who's trained. I can't follow the child around for weeks, so I need data that does. And I have parents and teachers fill out a series of questionnaires that are nationally standardized, not standardized on 100 children in Tooele. I take a history because it's the best thing I can do since I can't follow the child around. And then we decide, is there a need for some face-to-face testing? And often the face-to-face testing is designed to gather information about the child's other strengths or liabilities or academic achievement, not necessarily to prove or disprove that they have autism. Mm.
You have described, Dr. Goldstein, trying to get to this resilient mindset, a social resilient mindset. What do you mean by that?
Well, in my work with Dr. Robert Brooks from Harvard, we have gathered all of the research on what does it take for someone, in this case children, to deal with challenges and adversity and to develop the stress hardiness needed to transition successfully into the world. And in doing so, we appreciate that among these qualities, being connected to people, having a charismatic person in your life that you know cares for you, developing friendships, there is a significant relationship to how well you can socialize. And in doing so, we decided we would take the information we had and try and apply it as a model for parents raising children with autism. So it is not a book about raising an autistic child in the broader sense. It's not a handbook of raising a child with autism. It's specifically focused on what can parents do to help children with autism develop that social awareness. And then we coined the term a socially resilient mindset, specifically referring to your ability to go out into the world and deal with the social community.
Some of the things that these guideposts you've talked about, we don't have time to talk about all of them, but one of them is nurturing these areas of strength or these islands of strength. You've written this, Dr. Goldstein, that we have to come to recognize that to place the emphasis on fixing deficits limits our ability to assist children with ASD. This idea of finding these areas of strength, I guess that goes to Julia Adams, that her parents were able to find that her, I don't know if it's comfort zone, but one of her strengths, she was art, her connection to art.
Correct. If you have an ocean of inadequacy, you better have an island of competence or you drown. That's where how we coined the term.
Got it.
And so it's the first thing I do with every child I evaluate. I probably see 30 to 50 children with autism for assessment every year at our clinic. And it's the first thing I ask their parents is, what are they good at? What do they like to do? What do they enjoy? What gives them pleasure? And sometimes it's strange things. A parent will say he likes to dance around with a piece of string. And I don't know why he does that. So I'm not stealing away something from someone unless I know what purpose it serves them just because I don't like it. And sometimes their interests are more focused and make a better connection to all of us, as in this case, art. And for Julia, it was art. And she spent hours and hours, hundreds and hundreds of hours. And some parents would have been unhappy with that. They nurtured it. They appreciated that it was something special she could do. And I was evaluating her as she was graduating from high school last year. And she told me that she wants to be an artist, an illustrator. And I said, well, I'm working on this children's book to help all children understand autism. Do you want to try and illustrate it? And I had no expectations. I had seen some of the things she'd drawn. And 2 weeks later, she came back with two of those panels. And I fell out of the chair. And it takes her about 3 hours to draw each of those panels. She draws it very meticulously. She has perspective. She sees emotion in the faces of the characters. So it isn't that young people transitioning into adult life with autism don't get it. They get it. But they have a very challenging time using that knowledge they have to get out into the world. They understand it. And I have others who appreciate it, understand what they need to do, but struggle to do it. And Julia's art, I've had some artist friends look at her art and they just shake their heads. Her use of color, her use of texture, her perspective, it's just amazing.
Cheryl, was that helpful for you, the idea of identifying Carson's strength?
Well, I haven't turned his strengths into something that's marketable yet. But
and I'm not implying we have to.
No, of course
but
not.
But no, but I actually have this really great tutor, Garrett, and he has taken Carson and helped him make his own Disney videos. He's every character, and he films it, and then he puts it together, and Carson watches it back. But he uses his skills to make that happen. He writes the lines. He says the lines. He colors on the background. And it's been a cool thing because he can use what he's learned in school to do something, to make something.
We're getting a lot of different questions related to that transition from kid to adult, the relationship between Asperger's and autism, all those kinds of things. Let me just mention this: today's conversation is part one of a series of conversations, so I'm hoping we'll get to other kinds of questions. We're essentially out of time, and I wanted to ask you all this, something that came from Cheryl, an observation in the essay that she wrote, because she says she has to remind herself it's not the destination, but rather the journey. And I wanted you all to say something briefly, because we have about a minute left, but about that. Does that essentially get to the way you have to approach all of this, Cheryl? You can start.
Yeah, you can't wait for something at the end. It's just life with all of our typical kids, too. Enjoy the journey. Laugh. Make it fun.
Yeah.
I think parents who find a way to accept and take the time to see the world through the eyes of their children and aren't so caught up in change has to happen right away are probably better off, healthier psychologically and physically.
Yes, and the journey is where we learn everything along the way, and it will be one piece of advice that I leave with our graduates this evening. So, good advice.
Great. Dr. Jamie Christensen, Director of Schools for Spectrum Academy, based in North Salt Lake. They're expanding with a Utah County campus this fall. Thank you very much for joining
us. Thank you.
Cheryl Smith, President of the Autism Council of Utah, thanks to you and Carson.
Thanks.
Thanks very much for being with us. Dr. Sam Goldstein is a neuropsychologist here at the University of Utah, specializing in autism spectrum disorders, and he is the author of a number of books, among them the one we just mentioned that features Julia Adams, Billy, and the Rock Hounds. And Dr. Goldstein, welcome. Thanks very much for joining us.
I'm always happy to be here.
We're premiering, again, that short film about Julia and her art on Video West, videowest.kuer.org. It's directed by Salt Lake-based photographer Michael Schoenfeld, produced by Dr. Goldstein. In our favorites section, we should also mention we're highlighting a piece that I referred to earlier called Sensory Overload. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark, and I'm Doug Fabrizio.